Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. I'm your host, Victor, and in today's episode, primarily, I will be discussing the recently available Fallout video game adaptation on Amazon Prime. But also, I'll be discussing a couple of other post-apocalyptic science fiction adaptations, Three Body Problem on Netflix, and Invincible also on Amazon Prime, which just wrapped up its second season about a week or two ago now. And discussing the potential complexities of these dystopian science fiction adaptations. Most of this will be spoiler-free. For Fallout, I will have full spoilers. I will warn you when I get into the spoiler section of the Fallout review in case you are watching along or if you have not finished the series yet. Before all of that, I'd like to circle back on a bunch of topics that I've been meaning to get back to based on recent episodes. First of all, check the show notes. I'll have a lot of recommendations here for other post-apocalyptic and other science fiction material you may want to check out. I'll have links to them in the show notes, primarily via my Letterboxd. I'll probably create a list. I'll include it there. So follow me on Letterboxd so you can get some of these lists and other reviews and other supporting material for expansions of reviews and lists that I create here on the podcast. Your feedback also is always appreciated. Please reach out to us at needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Also, I had a little survey via emails with you who do reach out to us via email. I just had a question, which of course you could all participate in if you have any opinion on what you are looking forward to seeing in the next few months or in the season upcoming. And to a person, practically, the response was House of the Dragon, which we will definitely be discussing here on the show. By the way, did cover House of the Dragon, the first season here on the podcast. So if you are a new listener, do track those down if you're curious or just want to remember what happened in that first season of the show. And if there are other releases, movies as well, by the way, that you are interested in seeing, please do reach out to us, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com with that feedback. It helps me make a schedule of material here for the podcast. Until then, what is upcoming in the near future on the show? First of all, Guy Ritchie's new film is coming out this Friday, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, and I will be reviewing that, which honestly I think is going to be pretty inconsequential even in his filmography, but I am curious to see it. He is on a little bit of a hot streak, and I am pretty unapologetically a Guy Ritchie fan, but also taking the opportunity to discuss the very successful The Gentlemen series on Netflix. So that episode should be out before the weekend or over the weekend, discussing that film, and of course, The Gentleman Netflix series as well. And along with that, a retrospective of Ritchie's career, a very interesting, if uneven, career. And currently, I am in the midst of putting together a very long season-long recap of the Shogun series, the incredibly successful and incredibly impressive Shogun series, which just dropped episode 9, one episode to go at this point, just dropped that episode today as I'm recording this. I have not had a chance to see it. It just dropped this morning, but I will definitely be watching that in the near future. We'll be adding it to my season-long recap, and I'll be capping that off in the same episode, a live watch of the episode, commenting on it as I go through it, something I've done in the past with other season and series finales, most notably the Succession series finale, which was very popular for us here on the podcast. So stay tuned for all of that. I'm pretty certain it will be as impressive as the rest of the season has been. If you are behind on that, do catch up. It is definitely going to be one of the series of the year. And once Shogun wraps up next week, I'll begin coverage of the HBO series, The Sympathizer, which is produced by and prominently features Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, a novel that I am starting to read. I'm reading it in tandem with the adaptation. If you listen to this podcast regularly, you know that I'm always interested in adaptation of these works. And over the course of that coverage of that series, also discussing the works of the director Park Chan-wook, who not only directs most of these episodes, but is also a producer on the series. So some things you may want to add to your watch list, The Gentleman series on Netflix, which we'll be discussing later this week, along with that new Guy Ritchie film. The Sympathizers, episode 1, is currently available on HBO Max. And we'll be covering that beginning next week or late next week. And of course, catch up on Shogun, episode 9 out today, if you weren't aware. And if you haven't sampled that yet, really, it's as satisfying as it gets. And considering everybody's looking forward to House of the Dragon, if you want this palace intrigue series, this is the most satisfying thing on the air right now. And as a matter of fact, you may very well watch that series and think, oh, this reminds me of Game of Thrones. And of course, it was an inspiration to George R.R. Martin's series of books. So no coincidence there as well. So check that out. Okay, next up, I have a few follow-ups on recent episodes. Number one, I mentioned I was going to have a box office discussion on the current year. And as I had mentioned and predicted on that Civil War review episode last week, Civil War did indeed open at number one at the box office. And not only did it open number one, it's actually A24's largest opening weekend ever with over $25 million. This is a $50 million production for A24. So they needed this thing to make at least $100 million worldwide, probably hoping for something closer to $150. However, this is an aggressive move by A24 to move beyond their low-budget horror movies and genre films that they've been making up until this point, very successfully, by the way. I mean, as a matter of fact, they won most of the Academy Awards just 2 years ago with Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And then The Whale, a film I do not like, by the way, but does feature a strong central performance, winning Best Actor for Brendan Fraser. They basically swept all the top prizes that year. So A24 has been doing extremely well. They've also had some very successful TV productions. And this is a move to appeal to larger budgets and bigger stars. And it seems to be paying off for them. And also, as I predicted there, the film is very contentious. There is a lot of chatter on the internet as to what the goal of the film is. And A24 has kind of made a brand of being able to turn controversial and even divisive word of mouth into box office success. So this probably is all working for them. And I am curious to see what happens next week. Does the divisive word of mouth lead to a big drop in box office, or does it become a conversation point? Therefore, it becomes something that everybody has to watch to be part of the conversation. TBD, if you have watched it, do check out my coverage of it in the previous episode. Meanwhile, Godzilla versus Kong, or Godzilla X Kong, this is crazy, by the way, that the filmmaker says you're supposed to ignore the X, then why is it in the title? I don't know. Anyway. The sequel to Godzilla vs. Kong, which is called Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, meanwhile has made over $400 million worldwide and continues to perform well. It's number two at the box office currently. And this is actually interesting because, like Dune, it was part of this HBO Max, or now just Max, push by Warner Brothers, which led to Christopher Nolan, who had done almost all his films through Warner Brothers and been very successful with the Dark Knight series there, obviously. He actually abandoned Warner Brothers when he took Oppenheimer to Universal. And then, of course, thumb in the eye, they put Oppenheimer directly against Barbie, which was Warner Brothers' big film last summer. And they both won, which I think this was intentionally supposed to hurt one film or the other. And ironically, it turned into a huge success for both. The Barbie film ended up making around $1.5 billion. And Oppenheimer lost in terms of total box office, where it's just under $1 billion. But for a film that is mostly people talking, $1 billion box office is extraordinary, truly extraordinary. And of course, then goes and wins Best Picture as well. So Nolan made out, Warner Brothers made out, the controversy all worked out for both of them. But I bring all this up because Nolan actually abandoned ship from Warner Brothers, so upset with the fact that Warner Brothers was premiering their movies day and date in theaters and on HBO Max at the exact same time. And I was honestly a little surprised. I thought this would completely cannibalize the box office of the films. But then Dune came out and still made over $100 million in the US. And the Godzilla versus Kong film, the first one, also made over $100 million. And even better, overseas in both cases. So I was very much of the opinion, A, that they performed better than I expected, considering people could just stay home and watch them. I had watched the first Dune movie at home, by the way. Did not go to the theaters during the pandemic. It's available to me day and date at home. I'm going to watch it. And even if I like it, I'm probably not going to run out to see it in theaters. So I was very much on board with a lot of this criticism that Warner Brothers had turned prestige film going, or at least spectacle, into something you just watch at home. And this was what Nolan was complaining about also. So I bring all that up to say that the two biggest films this year are the Dune sequel and this Godzilla Kong film. So Warner Brothers actually did an incredible job of being able to launch Max. In retrospect, this was a huge success. They were able to put movies into movie theaters. People who were willing to go out saw them in movie theaters. The people who did not watched them at home. And rather than dampening interest in the follow-up, when they put them exclusively in theaters, people went back to the theater. So I did not predict this. I actually thought this would be a negative outcome from Warner Brothers, but I was wrong in this regard. And Warner Brothers has done a pretty great job of threading that needle. And just to close the loop on that, once again, Godzilla is probably going to end up with at least $500 million, probably more. Meanwhile, the Dune film is approaching $700 million and is still chugging along, especially internationally. Could hit $730, $740 worldwide, which is very successful. Another film that came out during the pandemic was the Ghostbusters reboot, Afterlife, which we discussed here on the podcast just last month. And of course, since that conversation, Frozen Empire has come out in theaters. I actually watched it. It was mildly entertaining. I think if you're a hardcore Ghostbusters fan, you're probably going to enjoy the film. If you liked Afterlife, you're probably going to enjoy this film. But I don't know what kind of legs this franchise has. This film may just make it to $200 million worldwide. Did not see an uptick post-pandemic that we saw for those other films I just mentioned previously. This one looks like it's going to underperform versus the previous film. So is there enough juice for this series to continue? I don't think so, honestly. And I go back to all the way back to Ghostbusters 2 and the question as to, does this franchise need to be turned into an extended universe at all? And yet they keep trying to, because there is something compelling about that first film, the nostalgia for it. But I think another reason is because the video games, the animated series from years ago, the side properties do seem to have a following. So there seems to be this question as to whether they can build this back up into a full franchise. But I think the feature films have always said no. Other than the first one, there's really not enough there to keep this franchise going. But they may very well reboot the whole thing again in 5 years and try again. The last follow-up topic I wanted to mention here was the Roadhouse episode. At the time, I was thinking to myself, well, why are they doing this? Why are they calling it Roadhouse? There was some pretty contentious internet conversation. People who were fans of the first film as if it was some kind of untouchable classic, which I honestly don't understand that. I think the charm of that first film is that it almost accidentally is an entertaining film. So the idea that people were thinking this was some kind of religious text was very strange to me. Regardless of that, I did have this open question as, why antagonize the fans? Why call this thing Roadhouse? You know the fans that are going to like it are probably not even aware of the first film. The fans that are not going to like it are going to come after you. And I had mentioned, hey, if you just say, hey, Jake Gyllenhaal's going to be jacked and he's going to be making a winking, somewhat campy, charisma-based punch-out film in this style of the original Roadhouse film, that would be a pretty attractive pitch to a lot of people. And I had a question in the podcast itself, like, why are they doing this? Why would they do it this way? A film that I found entertaining for the most part, by the way, the remake. And I asked that question to myself and thought, well, is it just because, hey, you know, even if people complain, just the name, the Roadhouse name will just attract some people. Maybe that'll juice the audience. And it turns out that's exactly what it was, because that premiere on Amazon Prime was hugely popular, by far their biggest movie premiere on that service. And it's as simple as that. It's the name recognition, for whatever reason, love it or hate it, complain about it or not, will simply attract an audience. And that's, in the end, what they're trying to do. So they know better than me in this regard as well. Okay, before I get into the Fallout review and commentary, there are two more science fiction adaptations that recently have been popular on streaming services that I wanted to discuss. I'll start with my briefest commentary around Invincible, also available on Amazon Prime. So if you are watching Fallout, do check out Invincible. Invincible is based on a comic book created by Robert Kirkman, who also is the creator of Walking Dead comic book. And it is a satiric exploration of the mythology of a Justice League type group of superheroes. The main character in the series is Mark Grayson, who also is Invincible, the superhero Invincible, voiced by Steven Yeun. And season one of this series is nearly perfect. There's maybe one or two episodes that even they pay off in the long run, although in the moment they seem a little shaggy. But in general, a very tight season one of that series. And basically what we have is Mark Grayson, this teenager who's trying to live up to his dad's standards. His dad is basically Superman in this universe of superheroes. He is from an alien planet, voiced by J.K. Simmons very well here. And the series explores this coming of age, hormonal, pubescent metaphor, which is very common in a lot of these comic book adaptations, along with this dark mythology around a super being, like a superhero who doesn't age, who has infinite power, living amongst humans. And this father-son dynamic is really, really powerful in that first season. I mean, the payoff at the end of the season is really terrific stuff. And minor spoilers only for the first episode. If you don't want to hear this, skip ahead a few seconds. At the very, very end of episode one, only episode one of season one, so I'm not spoiling much here. After being introduced to this superhero character, this benevolent force of good and infinite power and aspiration, he basically exterminates the entire remaining Justice League. And the rest of season one is a mystery as to what is his agenda and why has he done this. And simultaneously, Invincible, who is attaining his powers and, of course, trying to live up to his dad's example, and then his dad's conflicted feelings as he's trying to play both roles, and the mystery unraveling, of course, as to what's actually going on. And it deals really intelligently, has a lot of fun with this. There's a lot of comedians who do the voice acting here. It feels like a sitcom at times, like the goofy hijinks for these second-rate superheroes that have to replace the exterminated Justice League, but simultaneously dealing with these very deep issues of this complex relationship between father and son, and then these questions of what happens when you have absolute power. And that basically all is in season one. I won't tell you how it all wraps up. We're many twists and turns in that plot. So do check that out if that sounds intriguing to you. If you like The Boys, for example, definitely check this out. I have burned out on The Boys, to be honest with you. This is a much better version to me of The Boys is Invincible itself. So I prefer it. Also, if you want to just throw this in as another recommendation, last year we had Gen V, which was a adjacent series to The Boys in the same universe of The Boys. And these characters are actually going to be folded into The Boys. If you love The Boys, check that out. Your mileage may vary. I didn't really enjoy that series that much. There was a tragic death. One of the main cast members just died recently in a motorcycle accident, I believe, which has now delayed production of season two. I mean, that's a tragedy, of course, not a criticism of anything other than that it is a delay on production for season two and how they're going to handle that at all. But for me, this series itself was more of the same of The Boys. I was already kind of burned out on The Boys. And to be honest, the way that season one wrapped up, it was kind of just like, watch The Boys. I'm like, this is just a commercial for the next season of The Boys. It wasn't enough for me. If you love The Boys and can't wait to see the next season, it might whet your appetite a little bit. For me, it just wasn't that intriguing. I probably will watch season four of The Boys this summer on Amazon Prime. It is on its way, I believe in June or July. Yet another show that I would draw your attention to if you like these kind of dystopian comic book or superhero dissections, these explorations of these mythological topics, with, of course, a very dark sense of humor. If you like all that, then check out Gen V as well. However, for me, of all of these, Invincible is the best. Season two of Invincible, actually, they dropped the first four episodes. I think Amazon was just trying to keep their users engaged. I think this was a mistake in how they delivered the series. They did four episodes back in November, I think it was. And I didn't even mention it here on the podcast because as much as I loved season one of Invincible, I thought the first half of season two, so little happened. It had three or four different storylines that all seemed like they could support a full season of show or more than a season. And they would just hop around between these parallel stories. And I thought there would be some kind of culmination point in the first half of the season. There was nothing there. It was just basically the middle of the season drop. I don't think it was designed to be a half season. Once again, I think they just made them available to keep people on the hook, basically. So I didn't even discuss it. I was like, well, if there's any recommendation for anybody, wait until the full season is available. Well, now it is. And just about a week ago, maybe a week and a half at this point, the final of the season two episodes premiered. It's a mixed bag for me. I still recommend this very highly. If you are a huge fan of Invincible, if you're not a fan, you're not going to be converted by this second season of the show. However, if you are a big fan of the show, this is more of the same. It expands things. Once again, no spoilers here, but things are left in a very tenuous place at the end of season one. It does expand on that, but by definition, given that circumstance, some of the most compelling aspects of the story are not addressed for long periods of time. There is a new bad guy who's only teased throughout the whole entire season and then just shows up at the end, and it's not a very satisfying conclusion to him or his storyline. And I have heard that this is very true to the comic book itself. So it probably isn't a failure of adaptation other than not improving upon it, in that season two for me just felt like all set up for another season. There still is, at the end of that second season, not a lot of culmination of a lot of these ideas that are being addressed here. Some of the main characters, the most interesting characters from season one, are just teased here, maybe in the first half of season two, and then have completely disappeared from the second half. So maybe they should have brought in a little bit more for season three to have a more satisfying endpoint to things. I still am very intrigued for how this particular storyline will wrap up in the next set of episodes, which, who knows, will probably be at least a year before we see them, if not more. So a little disappointed in the amount of story that is covered here in season two. A lot of digressions, even more so than season one, where there's maybe like one or two episodes of flab on this storyline. There's probably half the season is honestly a little bit of side digressions that don't add too much to the central themes of the series, but all very watchable, all enjoyable. The animation style is improved between season one and season two. The voice performances are terrific. And there's some really knockout episodes here. In an ideal world, in my ideal situation, we would have two or three fewer episodes that we've seen here that are honestly just digressions to me, and maybe more of season three to have a more final endpoint to this storyline, and then building to a season three. Whereas here, I feel like we are almost in the middle of a season here. I honestly was like, oh, is the next episode available? Oh, there must be another one next week. Nope, that's the season finale. It was literally that feeling I had. I'm like, what? This is the finale? Okay, fine. So I did enjoy what was there, but not quite an exclamation point here at the end of the season. All right, one more adaptation and the complexities and failings, I think, of adaptations. Another very popular, but probably not as popular as they hoped, season of sci-fi television. Definitely something they hope to turn into multiple seasons once again. And this, of course, is the adaptation of The Three-Body Problem on Netflix. And this was based on a Chinese novel written in 2008 by Liu Cixin. I am almost certainly mispronouncing that. Apologies. And honestly, I have tried to read this book and could not get into it. It's so dense. I believe he was a scientist before he was a writer. And it shows he has these huge digressions on scientific theory. But the main storyline is so difficult to follow. But this is a very, very well-regarded novel, which has won Science Fiction Novel of the Year awards and was massively popular around the world. And this was had been adapted as a Chinese series a few years ago. But then Netflix announced that they were going to make a adaptation for the platform, adapted by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, along with Alexandra Wu. Of course, Weiss and Benioff most famously adapted Game of Thrones for HBO. And I have to tell you, this series didn't work for me. I watched it all the way through. Episode 5 has one of the most stunning and grotesque action sequences of the year. It will definitely be a conversation piece. You definitely want to watch that as long as you're not squeamish. But the rest of the series had a lot of the same issues I had with the book, even though I didn't complete that, obviously. It raises all these really fascinating questions. And maybe unlike the book, I should say here, whereas the book has these deep and long and, for me, too jargony digressions into these deep philosophical and scientific concepts, the series raises some really fascinating questions, but then doesn't have any space to explore them in any interesting way. And the characters are so sketched out, I just didn't feel like any of them were real people. So honestly, there was just enough intrigue, enough of me questioning what is happening for me to follow from episode to episode. I got through it, but I really didn't enjoy it. And I honestly can't recommend it. I can't recommend it as something to watch unless you are a hardcore science fiction fan. If you loved the books and you want to see some of this imagery brought to screen, perhaps you'll enjoy this. For me, it didn't really work. But it does make me think again about the difficulties of adapting something. Some of the decisions made here in adaptation are interesting and maybe important to Netflix, for example, making the cast in the novel, almost all Chinese scientists, into a international group of character actors, most of them recognizable from other things. Also taking one character and who's having philosophical discussions, and instead breaking them up into multiple characters so that those characters can have these philosophical disagreements, obviously makes sense given the fact you can't be inside someone's head like you can in a novel. That's almost essential for an adaptation. So those things are actually smart in the way they are handled. But for these two creators to have done such an excellent job, I think, in the early seasons, I mean, you could definitely, I have criticism of the final season of Game of Thrones for sure. But until you get there, those first few seasons of that show, which I've also read the books that they correlate to, I feel like they captured the essence of the book. They skipped things that worked in the book but weren't essential to the streamlining of the story. They bring in the philosophical discussion about the wielding of power and develop these themes really well and balance the spectacle with the philosophy and meditative aspects of the material in Game of Thrones. And honestly, as they get past maybe the second book, when George R.R. Martin's book series became overly bloated and verbose, I felt their streamlining, for the most part, worked really well. But it's a head scratcher for me as to how this adaptation was done here. It seems like anything that is worth exploring in any kind of detail is given a few minutes of high school level of engagement in the topics. And there are some really fascinating ideas about extraterrestrial life, of what happens when you know, unlike, let's say, climate change, which has some nebulous date in the future where it can have hugely negative impacts on society and obviously how we look the other way. What if there was a doomsday date set in stone, but it was in the far off future? How many people would decide to meet the challenge head on? How many people would just close their eyes and say, well, is that really going to impact me or my kids? It's probably not going to impact anyone that I know. But then, of course, you think, well, but your grandkids, your great-grandkids, they'll have impacts. And then how far is your empathy going to extend? So all the different ways that the society would deal with an impending disaster, which is still so far off in the future, is actually incredibly fascinating. Maybe a starting point for a television series, instead of something that is introduced in the 11th hour here and not really explored, when for me, it feels like that is the most interesting idea within the entire series. So very disappointed. The only big idea that I really latched onto was barely explored and delivered so late. So yeah, your mileage is really going to vary on this. If you're not into this kind of really dense sci-fi, for example, my sister tried to watch Cecilia, who's been on the podcast before, and she is very hit and miss with these things, and she hated it. She couldn't get past episode one. I did work my way through it. There was enough there for me to be slightly intrigued, but yeah, even I can't really recommend this by the time we get to the end. A couple things to call out, though. I do want to mention that that one sequence, I don't want to spoil it here, but it's in episode 5. Everyone will know it when you see it, which is just one of the most stunning things you'll see on TV and really just so grotesque. I was just like, wow, this is incredible. I can't believe this. I'm watching this right now. And really surprising. I guess you're not surprised if you read the book, but I hadn't read it, so I was not expecting it. It was pretty insane. So spoil yourself on that. You can practically watch that episode by itself and pretty much pick up enough context based on the first half of that episode, and then, of course, the payoff there towards the end. The second thing I find surprising is just the fact that this is such a huge hit in China, and that this wasn't banned, not to be too reductive about things, but not banned by the Chinese government, in the fact that this film opens with one of the main protagonists' father, who's a scientist and a professor in a university, being beaten to death by a bunch of Cultural Revolution infantrymen, or just the self-recruited radicals, something that happened frequently at the time, and how this communist revolution basically threw out all of science and threw out all of any ideas from the West, and this argument that just because something is politically unpopular doesn't make it a fact. You have to believe in the science, and that's the argument he makes right before he's killed. Of course, this kicks off the protagonist's mission that leads to all the events of this series decades later. But more interesting to me is this extremely negative view of the Cultural Revolution, the communist Cultural Revolution, and how the communist government, despite all of its censorship, allowed this book to be released and so popularly distributed. Okay, with that out of the way, I have some brief recommendations for some other movies and series you might want to check out in the vein of the series Fallout, which I will also be discussing here later in this episode, and I'll have spoilers in that commentary, but I'll warn you when that comes up. First of all, speaking of a film that was lost in the shuffle due to the pandemic, a film called Love and Monsters, in which Dylan O'Brien feels like an outsider in this utopian society that lives underground due to radiation poisoning on the surface of the Earth. Sound familiar? And he heads out on his journey to reunite with this girl that he was in love with before he had to live underground due to heavily mutated creatures above ground. Sound familiar? Very much in the tone of Fallout and even the visual style. Honestly, you could watch this film and just pretend this is occurring in the world of Fallout, as long as you change the reason for the mutations of the creatures on land. Not a nuclear fallout, but rather a meteorite, I believe, striking the Earth. And Dylan O'Brien, I never watched him on his TV series, is utterly charming here. A lot of fun as he traverses the countryside. This film, despite barely getting a release during the pandemic, actually was nominated for Best Special Effects. And I think the special effects are terrific in this film. Production in general, really great. What must have been a pretty low-budget film is utterly convincing here in this post-apocalyptic world that he lives in, this very convincing realization of it. And it just looks great. If you do happen to watch this, check out the underground imagery versus the Fallout series, which probably was much more expensive. And once again, just much more convincing in its production. And just one more recommendation, not a comedy in this scenario, but the series Silo, the Apple TV series, which takes place some 100 years or more in the future after some kind of nuclear fallout above ground where people all live in these underground silos, which are revealed. Minor spoiler here, is the second season of the series going to be called Silos? Anyway, once again, a direct correlation, similarity to the plot of the Fallout series here, based on a novel in that case. My criticism, by the way, we covered Silo here in the podcast. Do check out the back catalog for those episodes. If you are catching up on it, season two is on the way. I was not that enthusiastic about season one of the series, especially as it went along after the first few episodes, but yet am recommending season two because having my knowledge of the book itself, the really interesting plot-wise, action-wise, philosophical-wise aspects of the material haven't even been touched upon yet in the series. And that's part of my criticism. However, all of that is coming in season two. Basically, season one didn't even cover probably got to like 3/4 mark of the first book. And all the really interesting stuff, all the payoff for that is coming at the end of book one. And we haven't even gotten there yet, is basically my point. So if they continue a direct interpretation of the book one into book two, season two is going to start off with a bang. So that is why I'm looking forward to it. But do check that out. Apple TV Plus, the incredible Rebecca Ferguson at the center of that series. And hey, if you like Fallout and you want a more serious version of this story, check out Silo. Okay, finally, Fallout. This is an adaptation of the video game. We have quite a moment here of video game adaptation successes, whether that is in the family animation side of things with Sonic the Hedgehog, the third film on its way, and a TV series as well, spinoff, the Super Mario Brothers movie last year, a huge financial success. And even on prestige TV side of things, The Last of Us, a huge success for HBO last year. I believe the ratings for season one of The Last of Us was bigger than every season of Game of Thrones, aside from its final season. So basically, maybe the second most viewed season of any TV series ever for them. And even the Peacock series, Twisted Metal, once again, that could be a series that's taking place in the same universe of Fallout, the Anthony Mackie Peacock series, Twisted Metal, a series that I do not recommend. Maybe season two will be worth it. A much lower budget production of a post-apocalyptic world. But I'll just throw that onto the bonfire here as well of recommendations, if that's a proper metaphor. If you love Fallout and you like this vibe, this comedy violence, then check out Twisted Metal. I did very much find Anthony Mackie to be charming in the role. He's one of the producers on it. But the production, how little of the story progresses. But I did mildly say, well, maybe season two. really season one, this is like a disease among these streaming services now, is all a build up to what we want to see in Twisted Metal, which is cars racing each other across the country, which is basically where we land at the end of season one. And boy, getting there is rough. But that series has its fans, and I'm pretty sure there will be a season two there at some point. So yet another video game adaptation you may want to check out. But Fallout is already much more successful than the Twisted Metal video game adaptation, and we will almost certainly be seeing a second season of this one. So if you listened to the podcast last week, you did hear me briefly mention that I had seen the pilot episode of Fallout, and I was very enthusiastic by the sprawling scope of it and the production design and the tone management of being able to be very goofy and silly and yet have some darker elements introduced. And what I would say is the rest of the season, I finished the entire season, doesn't quite live up to the pilot episode, but it's good. It's good enough that I would recommend it. This comes from Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, Christopher Nolan's brother. And Jonathan Nolan also directs the first three episodes of this season. The series takes place in an alternate history where around the 1950s, I believe it is, the Cold War with the Soviets leads to a nuclear apocalypse worldwide. At the start of the series, we see in that time period in the 1950s, Walter Goggins, the excellent Walter Goggins, always excellent, is a Hollywood cowboy, but for reasons we still don't understand, has been reduced to doing children's birthday parties with his daughter in tow. And at this moment, nuclear bombs start detonating all over Los Angeles. It's in a truly amazing sequence visually. He jumps on his horse with his daughter, riding through the mountains of Los Angeles while the city is destroyed in the background. We flash forward in time and we meet Ella Purnell and her dad, played by Kyle MacLachlan, who live in an underground bunker. The world is not livable, although radiation levels are low enough where they believe soon that they'll be able to return to the surface. They live in this underground utopian society, but once again, shades of Love and Monsters, she's unable to find a good marriageable spouse, and they decide to invite some of the residents of the adjacent Vault 32. They're from Vault 33. There's an adjacent Vault 32. There's also a nearby Vault 31. And occasionally, residents move from one vault to the other, and there is to be a wedding ceremony. And things go badly, I won't explain how, which all leads to Ella Purnell's character, Lucy, heading out into the wasteland on her mission. Meanwhile, above ground, the Earth is not uninhabited, but rather is inhabited by roving gangs of wild people. So they've survived on the surface, oftentimes mutated. For example, Walter Goggins, once again, is not only playing this cowboy in the flashbacks, he is this zombie-like creature in the present tense, horribly disfigured, with his skin practically burned off and no nose, which apparently is common among these zombie-like creatures we find on the surface. Some zombies go pure zombie, like George Romero, flesh-eating zombie style, while some are still intelligent, but just can't be killed, basically. Good old shot to the head still works, as you would expect from other zombie stories, but he is like the man with no name. This is Fistful of Dollars. This is Sanjuro. He is a samurai for hire. He is amoral and only looking out for himself, but he is on a mission and maybe not as craven as he appears to be. And all of that is explained over the course of this relatively short series, 8 hours long or so. One more key player in the cast here, above ground, Aaron Moten, the actor playing Maximus, who's a member of a Halo-like military group who maintains the peace in the wildlands, the wastelands above ground. But he is a squire for these knights, as they're named, wearing the armor itself. And he is bullied and has a tragic backstory and has ended up in this fascist police organization within this totalitarian regime, which may be a sham, actually, at this point. We may be looking at a completely collapsed society at this point. And everybody here is just pretending to maintain the order. And basically, this bullied and abused squire ends up inside of one of those mech suits. And these three storylines, these three characters, this very Western set, wasteland, roving, zombie-like samurai hitman and this armor-clad high-tech warrior and this girl who has escaped from this underground utopian society are all on a collision course to unravel this very large conspiracy of what actually led to their current circumstance and what is the grand scheme and how are they all kind of pawns in this broader conspiracy. As the story progresses, we move backwards and forward in time. Walter Goggins' character connects these two timelines since he has lived this whole entire time. Now this single-minded revenge machine in the present tense, but then this doting father in the past tense who even then was starting to uncover a broader conspiracy, which leads to the events of today. We really don't see a lot of what that broader conspiracy is, but that is all tantalizingly set up for season two. And the three main characters all do a good job of pulling you into the story. Ella Purnell playing Lucy McLean. We've seen her here on the podcast previously, by the way. Of course, we have covered here season one and season two of Yellow Jackets. She played Jackie in Yellow Jackets. Walter Goggins, of course, playing the dual role of Cooper Howard and the Ghoul, as he's known in the present tense of this series. Also plays Cecil, by the way, on Invincible, if you do catch up on Invincible and recognize the voice. And Aaron Moten playing Maximus. So do check out the pilot episode here, available on Freevee as well, by the way. So if you don't have Amazon Prime, you can check out Freevee for the pilot episode. And I would say the rest of the series, not as great as that pilot episode, but if you are engaged with that pilot episode, stick with it. I think it does set up a pretty intriguing mystery, a lot of potential for season two, but gives us a pretty satisfying closure for season one as well. Not as irritating as the unanswered questions that often are the case with these streaming shows. I was relatively satisfied with the ending here. So that's the end of the spoiler-free section. If you're opting out before the spoilers, just a couple of quick notes if you'd like to support the podcast. I know we've had a lot of new listeners in the past few weeks, and if you are new to the podcast and would like to support us, recommend this to your friends and family if they happen to be watching any of these shows or are looking for recommendations for things to watch, and give us a positive review or rating on your podcatcher of choice. Okay, here come the full spoilers. So the inciting incident of the plot here in the story is that during this wedding ceremony that's been set up for Lucy with the residents of Vault 32, Lucy's dad, played by Kyle MacLachlan, Hank, is abducted and basically the rest of the crew is left to die. By the way, some of the leadership here in Vault 33 include Zach Cherry, for example, from our beloved Severance, also covered here on the podcast, season two finally coming of that show. We will definitely be covering it here in a podcast, and check out our season one coverage of that series as well. After Hank is abducted, the Vault 33 folks are actually able to fend off these outsiders from the surface, basically masquerading. The invitees from Vault 32 turned out to be surface dwellers, and they were on a mission specifically to abduct Hank. Lucy loves her dad and is committed to escaping with the help of her brother, Norm, played by Moises Arias, and her cousin, who she used to do cousin stuff with, quote-unquote, Chet, played by Dave Register. And while Lucy is working her way across the wasteland, they're investigating underground and discovering that the people in Vault 32 had not been killed by these scavengers, but rather had been dead for a very long time. And what unfolds over the course of the season is what's actually been going on in these underground vaults. Through the flashbacks, we find out that these vaults were being sold to rich Americans as ways to protect themselves from inevitable nuclear war. We turn out, this is very late in the season, to discover that the best way to maximize their profits was to sell these underground accommodations to the wealthy, and then to not only protect against nuclear war, but to initiate a nuclear war, therefore making their product utterly vital, and more importantly, then hoarding that wealth over time. As they say over and over again, time is the differentiator between being extremely wealthy and not, and letting that wealth grow over time. So if there's a big idea here, there is this criticism of the illogical nihilism of pure capitalism. But there are some other interesting thematic elements here as well. We see that Lucy lives by the golden rule. She always tries to do unto others as she would have done unto herself. And you see that butting up against the Ghoul's philosophy of every man for themselves. And by the end of the series, they too are very much aligned in their investigation of this broader mythology. They are both looking for Lee Moldaver, played by Sarita Chowdhury, who has abducted Hank, and also has been, along with everybody else, has been looking for this infinite power resource, cold fusion, which has been hidden away in the head of a scientist that has escaped with this priceless technology. This scientist called Wilzig, played by Michael Emerson, who's worked before with Nolan on Person of Interest, for example, and of course, very recognizable from Lost. He's just one of many cameos here in the series. We have Michael Rappaport here as well, Fred Armisen, looking much older than the last time I saw him, as well as Matt Berry from What We Do in the Shadows. Very entertaining here and relatively small part. And there is a big action sequence at the end of the series in the final episode, where once again, we see this pretty impressive budget that they've probably been allocated here, used to its full extent. So it is uneven, but overall, an entertaining watch and does explore some of these ideas of a purely amoral profit motive for every decision by these powerful characters, the illusion of security and what we sacrifice for that, the counterpointing of doing the right thing for the right reason versus doing the selfish thing all the time, and almost a philosophical examination of those two things and how maybe they balance each other out. But primarily, this is just a romp. As I've mentioned before, these same creators were the showrunners for Westworld, another series that had many big ideas, was much more serious than this one here, but then struggled to deliver on those ideas long term. There are ideas here, but they are relatively secondary to this episodic odyssey across this wasteland. And there's enough detail and enough characterization and enough solid performances here to make the whole world worth exploring and visiting. Now, I have not played the video game at all. Does this match up? Is this better? Is this worse? From what I've heard, this is in the universe of Fallout, maybe touches briefly on some of the mythology of that, but the storyline itself is completely unique, so you do not need to be a fan of the video game to follow along with this at all. And if anything, it might be additive if you are a fan of the game. So if you have played the game and are now watching the series, and you've listened this far into the podcast, drop me an email, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Tell me if this is a good adaptation in your opinion or not. Okay, so that's the end of the episode for now, this episode. Once again, some homework for you if you'd like to follow along here on what we're watching on the show. Catch up or finish The Gentlemen. I still have not finished that series myself, but I will definitely be finishing the Netflix series, The Gentlemen, a show I've been very much enjoying, by the way, up until this point, just haven't got around to finishing it yet. Along with a retrospective Guy Ritchie's career, and, of course, the latest Guy Ritchie film in theaters this weekend. And then expect a very long, I believe, episode of the podcast next Tuesday or Wednesday, right after the release of the season finale of Shogun, a truly extraordinary series of television. So I hope you enjoy some of those recommendations and some of that content, and I'll talk to you soon.